Hey, everybody, if you're based in New York City and looking for a space to rent out for a meeting or a screening during daytime hours, you need look no further. Videology Bar and Screening Room at 128 Bedford Avenue in Brooklyn is renting out its space and facilities for the low price of $25 an hour. I don't think that exists anywhere else. This discounted price will last at least through the month of July, this summer. And if you mention that Film Wax Radio sent you, they'll give you an additional 10% off. Making it only $22.50 an hour to rent out a fantastic venue with everything you need right at your disposal. Videology is located just blocks from either the Bedford stop on the L line or the Marcy Avenue stop on the JMZ line. Email Wendy at videology.info if you're interested. And remember, tell her that Film Wax Radio sent you and you'll get another 10% off their hourly rate. And now on with the show.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. I hope you're doing well. This is Film Wax Radio, episode 301, with your host, Adam Chartoff.
That's a pretty mediocre Scottish accent. I'll do better next time. I think what I'm going to have to do is every so often just do an entire show, you know, with some accent.
Wouldn't that be great? That would just be fantastic.
You know, it's like Marin. Who, you know, I'm sure you heard the interview with Obama. I don't know. No comment. It was, of course, it was a fantastic interview. I'm just licking my wounds here. I don't, just to get a fraction of any of that would be pretty wild. But, you know, at least he's done a lot for the podcast, period. Yeah, for that whole space in the world. He's done a lot to bring it to the forefront. So good for Marc Maron. Meanwhile, I'm here doing my own little thing. Most of the time, I'm running around. I live in New York City, so it's very easy for me to get anywhere within a half hour or so to meet with a filmmaker or, you know, a distribution person or a journalist or, somebody and sit down with them. But later this year, I am going to somehow figure out how to create a studio situation where I can invite people on a more permanent basis. And that might include, I'm just saying it now, it's episode 301, right? We're starting fresh with this episode. I'm just putting it out there. I may crowdsource I might do it. I've been kicking it around. I've been mostly giving myself every reason why I should not do it, which I think is probably the proper way to go about such a thing. You know, you should probably think to yourself, okay, let me think of other ways I can raise money on my own. But, you know, the truth of the matter is I need a lot of new equipment, and, you know, I want to get it soon. And so that's the thing. So that way I can have like kind of a more permanent space and a portable space of the show. I can have a permanent version and a portable version of a studio in a way too. So I could and the quality, the sonics, everything. People don't have to share microphones. I can edit at a more of a clip. You know, there's many different reasons. So I don't know. I'm just kind of formulating that in my mind. Okay, on to the show. What do you think of the John Sayles show? I don't know. What did you think? He was pretty cynical. I mean, I'm listening back, and I don't mean that in a bad way, but I was listening to it, as I was editing the show, and I was thinking, my God, he's delivering a lot of cynical information about filmmaking today. But, you know, but he doesn't come off that way at all when you're talking to him. He's not a grumpy guy at all. He's not, I think he's actually a fairly positive person, you know, or he's just kind of being realistic and sober about it. So it's just his perspective. You know, and this is coming from practically 40 years in the business. I had a party for my 300th party. I mean, maybe a dozen people were there, but it was like a little get together for drinks last night. And we were talking about John Sayles. He says, "I'm not the biggest John." I'm like, he was saying that, you know, all the films were slow. And I'm like, there are easily six John Sayles films that stand up. And I said, "Secaucus 7." He said, "Never saw it." I said, "Baby, it's you." He said, "Never saw it." "The Brother from Another Planet." "Okay, I love that one." And then I was like, you know, Lone Star, Eight Men Out, and of course, Matewan, which everybody thinks is Matewan. And by the way, I understand that. I have family from Matewan, New Jersey. I believe it is Matewan is the way you pronounce it. So there you go. We had a good time, and we're on to episode number 301. So let's talk about that, okay? Episode number 301, David Gordon Green back for his third appearance. So that first David Gordon Green show, I think we were talking about, must have been Prince Avalanche, yeah. And then he came back on to talk about Joe, you know, with Nicolas Cage. And that came out great. I'm very excited about that. This one, we talked a lot about Manglehorn, about Al Pacino and Holly Hunter. And, you know, it was nice to have this time. I hope to bring him back on, though, one point or other where we can just schmooze for a long time. So I'm going to try to make that happen. So you'll get to hear David Gordon Green. Manglehorn, by the way, his movie is... actually opened last Friday. I apologize for being late with this episode, but, you know, I had the 300th I had to do. And so this one got delayed. So normally I would have had this show up way before, but I just didn't get around to it. So I apologize to IFC Films for that delay. I can say, however, that the good news is Manglehorn's being expanded and extended. It's being extended, I believe, in New York City and L.A., and I believe it's going to other spots. But it's also... on demand, so you can watch it. And we'll put up where on the show page. You know, I'll put up the links to what I assume is iTunes and probably, I'm guessing, see it. It's a great, quirky film. I mean, it's a very entertaining. Chris Messina, the actor, who might also be known for, he's in The Mindy Show and a bunch of other stuff. He does a lot of TV as well. Chris Messina's in it. And, of course, Harmony Korine, the filmmaker, who most recently, of course, had James Franco in... Spring Breakers. So this is what's great about this film, though. I mean, this interview is Al Pacino's, you know, stories, of course. So there'll be plenty of those, and how his response to having seen Spring Breakers, for one thing, and Prince Avalanche and other films that you wouldn't think. It's hard for me to visualize Al Pacino sitting through Spring Breakers, but and what would he make of that? This is the guy that was in, you know, The Godfather. But nevertheless, that's what he did. And then on to the second segment with Patrick Bryce, who directed The Overnight, which is currently out. I believe it's still out. I believe it will probably be out for a while. It's certainly a great comedy, which is probably playing wide. And then you have Creep, which is currently on demand also on iTunes. And again, I'll put up those links for you. But Creep stars Mark Duplass and Patrick Bryce, just the two guys in this film, and they both collaborated on it. So you can see both The Overnight and Creep right now. They're both available for your viewing pleasure. And then finally, the third segment is with the author, Josh Karp, who made a movie called Orson Welles' Last Movie, which is, of course, about the making of The Other Side of the Wind. And we're going to get into that, too, because speaking of Indiegogo campaigns, there is one currently going on to raise $1 million. And I know it's winding down. I'll talk about it in my intro to that third segment. Okay, so we'll get to that in just a minute. But let's just right now jump into my conversation with the director of George Washington, All the Real Girls, Your Highness, Pineapple Express. So plenty, lots and lots of great films. He did some broader comedies, some serious films, and now he's going through a phase where he's considered offbeat. And this, I think, is his real wheelhouse here. I think they're not super serious. They're not either, you know, that they're kind of light. They're serious comedies in a way, you know. Or I don't even think they're dark comedies. They're just sort of character-driven, you know, stories with... that are kind of unpredictable in nature, and not just the storyline, but in the actual presentation of the films. And so he's doing something kind of unique, and I appreciate it. So let's go into my conversation with David Gordon Green.
Manglehorn, lock and key.
Locked in a filthy car.
How are you doing there?
He looks happy. Dear Clara, how I missed you. You know, not a day goes by where I don't miss you deeply.
Never have I felt more alive than when you looked at me. I got real pain in my heart.
This is Coach Maggie basketball, all sport coach.
Need some money? I give you a loan if you need one.
No, I don't need your money. I just came to see my son, you know?
Oh, Fanny, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to scare you last night. I had to get in my boat. I got a boat with Fanny. Get on the ocean and just disappear.
What would I do without my friend around? You know, I'd be sad on Fridays.
I think Manglehorn was there, actually, this year.
That's what I think. Yeah. I was, like, at there, and then... Was that in there, or, like, the Montclair? Because it happened.
It was there, too. I went to Montclair. Yeah.
You were there, right?
2 weeks ago, yeah.
I tried to get over there for your for that.
Dude, it was a spellbinding Q&A.
Did Holly go?
She didn't. I can't remember why she couldn't go at the last minute.
Well, you know, the thing about that, I mentioned I have a kid, and he goes to the same school as her kids. So
oh, really?
I see Holly Hunter, like, all the time.
Nice.
And she came up to me the other day, and started chatting, I don't think we've booked this quite yet, because I would have sort of said something about it. But I keep resisting the urge to that you want to come on my podcast because, you know, I figure right, I should try to become good friends.
She's amazing.
She is amazing. That's the thing. Raising Arizona was like, changed my life.
I know that movie by heart. Yeah.
It's my favorite movie. It's like, you know, I have such great memories of seeing
it. I saw that movie 100 times.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's fantastic.
It's probably the best Coen Brothers movie, I think.
It's up there. I mean, certainly as far as like just
pure
well, your
fun.
Friend, of course, your good buddies in it, right? Nick Cage.
Oh, yeah.
And,
Unleashed.
yeah.
But so, I mean, the best lines in that movie are like, Les Round is funny. You know, like yeah. the little side characters in that movie are priceless.
Yeah, I haven't seen it in a while, so you're probably better quoting lines, but I just love the way she said his name. Hi. She just loved it. Oh, with dip test. Do we get the dip test? You know.
Get the dip test.
she was so great. So I would love to, but I'm definitely feeling like careful about it because I don't want to blow it. Like right. If she says she's put off by it. I know somebody who is like an actress and she said that she was like she's not a star or anything like that, but she said she was on the set with Holly Hunter and they became very friendly, you know, of course, because she's so sweet and so nice. And then at the end she asked for some reason, she said, I don't know why, but I felt compelled to ask for her autograph. And I could just see the switch go
off.
Oh,
man.
Like, you know, why would you do
yeah,
that?
Yeah, I guess you got to be careful of that.
So that's kind of the thing. It's not because I heard that anecdote about her specifically, but I kind of think about, mm-hmm. like, if your relationship is based in it this way, maybe you got to be real careful. But I'll say, you know, I'll feel her out, and I'll say, David said you should do this.
Yes.
He's endorsing it. So.
Exactly. Excuse me and blame me when she punches you in the face.
I would love that. Give me a black eye, right? Can you imagine? Holly Hunter gave me this. How do I?
She had a punch, man. She's smart.
Yeah, she's great in smooth transitions. She's great in Manglehorn, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Very moving performance.
Yeah, she's awesome in it. She was really fun to work with, and working with it was just amazing to have these two. I don't know, two of my idols in the acting world, and
Incredible.
Being able to sculpt something for them to go toe to toe and have scenes that aren't mm-hmm. so busy that they can't just sit there and listen to these two characters talk in a mm-hmm. either civilized or uncivilized manner.
I don't know if you recall it all because you do so many probably interviews, but the last time I met you, you were just a Joe, I guess. No, it was actually maybe what? I don't remember exactly, but all I do remember is you said you were about to show Manglehorn. I said, what? What's that? Because I was a step behind, you
uh-huh.
know? Now I'm catching up a little bit
yeah.
there, but I was just a little step behind. So you were just mentioning, oh, I said, Manglehorn, what's that? Because it sounds like such an incredible name. And he said, oh, it's just a movie I just finished with Al Pacino. And I'm like, what? And I was like, you saved that? You buried the lead, but we had to talk about Joe, which is incredible. You went from these two incredible actors that I don't want to insult them in the least bit because both have earned such, you know, esteem in terms of the performances, but they've kind of also known to overact at times and both are very restrained performances, you know. What do people make of Al Pacino in this movie? Because you warned me and it was really was like the strangest thing one of the stranger things I've seen him in, but I loved every minute of it.
Well, that's great. That's great to hear. You know, to me it was engineered for Al and it's scripted in many ways as a love letter to him and to his...
Yeah.
You know, even reflected in the art direction, you'll see there's a bank and we've got little echoes of the bank in Dog Day Afternoon, or you'll see, a line may pop up that may be a little bit familiar without being exact plagiarism, or a sentiment may be reflected from somewhere, set dressing. So, you know, just being very fluent in the, you know, in the films of Pacino, it was cool to be able to try to steer him in a direction that he's never been in before. And that's really challenging because he's been in a number of movies. But this one in particular was trying to channel some of his earlier 70s movies, Scarecrow, Panic in Needle Park, Godfather, that I think were more defined by the restraint of a character rather than necessarily the bravado.
Right. When there may have been more of a vulnerability in his performance because he hadn't developed into Al Pacino yet.
Exactly. And you know, this is a love story in a lot of ways, and I wanted it to play like this is almost an 11-year-old. So anything in our efforts of our dialogue and constructing this character was referring to the youth, really, and really putting him in that innocent, naive place, but with the eyes and body of a 75-year-old man. So trying to juxtapose some naive qualities within the cynical qualities, or things of beauty within things that were very ugly, or things that are very melancholy with things that are magical.
Right. Oh, yeah. Well, it was had to be a very... I don't know, precarious line because, you know, as you said, he's been making films for like over 40 years and you want to keep him a little off kilter, if possible, on some level? Did you?
Yeah, absolutely. And
did he want that? Your chemistry like? I mean, did he want that from you?
Yeah, and I think some of it was challenging. You know, it was like we'd go from a scene where we just nailed it, and like we just feel the electricity between, you know, Pacino and Chris Messina, who plays the son, and we just feel really confident. And the next thing I'd say, Al, you got to get up in that tree with a cat and just sit up in that tree branch, and which is nerve-wracking to be higher than you could actually climb in a tree with a cat. You've got the responsibility of not falling and
acting.
A cat
and acting. Yeah, yeah, like you're not afraid of falling potentially, or maybe he was afraid, so he had to act like he wasn't afraid.
Yeah.
As a character who was afraid.
Yes, exactly. You know what I mean?
So, yeah, there is that, isn't there?
So I do like a little agitation. I like to find out where our comfort levels are and maybe explore crossing them. And all the time having a great sense of humor. And it was just such a lighthearted set in a lot of ways with the crew being so close. And, you know, we've been making movies for 15 years together now. And and having new wild cards like Holly Hunter or Harmony Korine just there to entertain us. Yeah. And make sure that nothing ever really got too dramatic. It was fun to be able to have a really seemingly serious work environment, but a lot of laughs and a lot of, you know, late night dinners and drinks.
Mm-hmm. Was Pacino there for a lot of those?
It would be literally in the middle of a rough scene. He'd be like, I got the energy to get through the scene, but we're going to need to go out and have some fun tonight.
Oh, yeah. That must have been music.
Well, because
music to your ears.
He really invests himself in these characters, and it can be really draining, as I can only imagine. I mean, seeing the best of the best of these guys that really do transition into other people's bodies in a lack of a more eloquent way to say it. And it's exhausting and it's frustrating, and to do it to the level of, you know, of reality that these guys do, Pacino, even Holly, and, you know, Nick Cage in the last movie. I just really respect it. And when they say, "Hey, man, I need to cut loose because I can't live like this," it's good to do it.
Yeah, yeah. But the material has to be there too, because they want to transform, or they're willing to. But the material has to be there for them to be able to kind of do it. The script has to be there, and the direction.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's how you invite them to the party. It's like you have something to offer them that they haven't done ever or in a long time, or something that they feel like would be a fresh air in their process. Mm-hmm. I do have a really playful process, and I don't have this kind of steadfast, hard-hitting way that vision that needs to be, you know, storyboarded and blocked out and memorized and line readings and things like that. I invite guys like Al to come and participate and collaborate and shake it up, and let's, you know, try this way, and then that didn't work. Let's do this over here. Let's cut all the dialogue out and, you know, do it while we're dancing.
Is Holly Hunter from North Carolina?
She's not. She
is. Or is she from Georgia?
She's
from one of those states, right? Isn't she?
Yeah. I was going to say Mississippi, Georgia, somewhere in there.
Deep South, though.
Yeah.
So do you guys have the connection there a little bit, or?
Yeah, you know, she's got a beautiful accent, I gotta say that.
Yeah, I know.
And yeah,
now it's in Brooklyn.
Yeah, she's been up here certainly for a long time, and very prominent in the theater world, and an incredible range, and just, you know, an actress I've always really admired, and, you know, anything from The Piano to Raising Arizona to Broadcast News, you know, these just real standout roles that she's had that show a diversity and a light and a humanity, which is what made her perfect for this, is the contrast. If Pacino's character is kind of this, monochromatic gray, black, brown kind of heavy fabriced character, she's somebody that's, you know, not afraid of turquoise and peach.
Mm-hmm. Did they admit to watching some of your early work, or did that was that part of their due
diligence? Never to see my work and never really? To talk to my mom about who I was as a kid. Those are my two rules. I know Pacino had seen Prince Avalanche because he would make jokes about it, which I thought was funny. And Holly, I don't know. I don't really get into that too much. You try not to be such a suck up that I start asking them about too much. Although with Pacino, I wanted to hear a lot of Marlon Brando stories, and so amazing hearing him talk about the vulnerability he had the first time going to meet Brando on the set of The Godfather and things like that. So just I'm a sucker for a good 70s Hollywood story.
Oh my gosh. To be a fly on the wall, right, man? Well, I kind of feel that way with you. Like, I don't want to dwell too much on, asking you Al Pacino stories, but I have to get, I don't think Pacino is going to necessarily do this show, although, I'm not going to, who knows? But, I'm really kind of, curious, and there's not tons of time, but I needed to get a, if you have one Brando story that, I don't know if you can remember that. Not to put you on the spot at all.
Like the beauty of my job is I get to be part-time psychologist, part-time storyteller, part-time get in there and see what's going on in their brains, and having him talk about, what was it, Brando was eating beef stroganoff with his bare hands, and like that's just awesome to imagine. Just licking his fingers and wiping it on the bed sheets, and I like to picture stuff like that, and just the salty, funny, strange world of the 70s, which is the most incredible decade of American cinema that there will ever be.
Yeah, and those days are like nobody's doing that. Everybody's so cautious and
Everybody, you got to choose your battles and find your outlets and platforms for where you want to get weird.
Find your own beef stroganoff or whatever.
Exactly.
Harmony Korine, also very memorable. So, Pacino. I'm not going into too much detail in terms of a synopsis because I figure I can do a little bit of that in the intro that I do. But and then people can just go see the movie for lots of those details. But yeah, he's definitely the classic Pacino is the classic curmudgeon, and he's sort of estranged himself or alienated himself from most of the people in his life. But he has his cat, who he loves, and he's a locksmith.
Yeah.
And the local bank teller has a crush on him, played by Holly Hunter. And I'm just sort of contradicting myself. I'm doing the synopsis anyway. So he was a former coach, though. He had done some coaching in his past, right? And so Harmony Korine plays this guy who loved Pacino and still kind of wants to, show him his love, right? And so that was kind of unique, good casting. Did Pacino know of Harmony Korine, know what he was getting into at all? Did he, at the end of it, did he, threaten you?
They're all friends now. I think Pacino's going to be in Harmony's new movie now.
Come on.
Which is, that's what the rumor is.
Really?
I don't know if that's public. Maybe.
It is now.
It was the most fun between setups that you could have is just listen to these guys tell tales, and Harmony's just got wonderful energy. I cast him because I saw a Q&A he did at South by Southwest for Spring Breakers, and I just thought, that guy's electric. He's on fire. What's going on? And it really was Pacino after the first take, he's like, who is this guy, Robin Williams? Because he just goes and goes and goes, and it's just really, really awesome having somebody that is capable of, taking the cork out and just going nuts on a roll.
Yeah. Before Pacino caught up with caught up with a little bit of his
Harmony. I remember him. He watched Spring Breakers and then came back and told me all about it as if I hadn't seen it.
Well, he is an older guy, and that is the law. I think you have to tell stories. Retell them. I think that's part of I'm doing it already. Okay, so Manglehorn is going to be out in a couple of weeks, right? June 19th or something? I think it's June 19th.
I think so.
June 19th. And also, is it going on digitally out too?
I think so.
I think so too. What, now I can spend a couple of minutes because I'm curious, always curious about what your next project is.
My next project, I'm just...
Are you just winding down on something, aren't you?
I'm winding down on a movie I did with Sandra Bullock called about Bolivian politics called Our Brand is Crisis. It's a...
Our Brand is Crisis?
Yes. It was inspired by a documentary with the same title about a group of American political consultants in South America. And so we're finishing that movie up, and that's going really well. It's been a lot of fun working with Sandra Bullock and Billy Bob Thornton.
This is the new Oscar-winning Sandra Bullock? Did she win the Oscar? I can't remember.
She won for
Did she win?
Blindside, I think. I don't think she won for Gravity.
Okay. Sorry. I interrupted you.
Often nominated. And most importantly, an awesome lady and a super great actress. So that was it's been a lot of fun traveling around and working with her.
Can I ask you, is this for hire? Did you write this? You didn't write
it. I did not write it.
Seems a little bit.
British writer, Peter Strawn, wrote it. And it was something that, it's at Warner Brothers, and it's just a great opportunity to try to, for me, take some of my comedic impulse and put it in a serious-minded film. You know, kind of like an Argo did, I guess. Like, there's a great wit to the characters.
Is there some satire there? Is that what?
Not in a spoofy way, but in a, like, a cultural commentary a little bit. And so it's just taking a group of unlikely Americans into a culture out of their element a little bit.
Okay.
But it's been a ton of fun. We're finishing that up. And then on Monday I start shooting a new Amazon series. And then in July I do a new HBO series. So I got a big summer ahead.
Wow, congratulations. Where are you shooting the Amazon?
All over. Okay. It's about a Jewish country club in the 80s. So, we're bouncing around.
No wasps need apply. can you take a couple? Do you mind taking a picture?
Yeah.
Because for the, if you don't mind.
Huh? Should if I take my shirt off or leave it on?
Oh, please, I'll take mine off. Thank you so much.
These people in my life standing here, they're waiting for a miracle.
Well, maybe this other woman, maybe she'll return. And maybe you'll remember how to love someone more than an animal.
You don't know who I am!
But none of them mean a thing to me.
I'm sorry.
Just making fun of me.
It'd be great if you'd be a father.
So now you're a son of a bitch.
Yes.
Why do you hate everyone?
You know, balloon belongs in the sky where it came from. Yes. Oh, it gets lonely. I love you very much.
I love you too. Thank you for my lion.
See you next week.
All right. The Overnight, by the way, is definitely going to be in New York City. It was at the Angelica, which I think it's wrapping up today at the Angelica. So, but if you didn't get a chance to see it, The Overnight, it will be at the Nighthawk in Brooklyn. It will be at AMC Lowe's Kips Bay. It will be at the AMC Empire, and that's just New York City. So check your local listings for The Overnight, because it's going to be out at least for another week in a wide sort of manner. So go check it out. The Creep is on iTunes, so you can watch Manglehorn and Creep today if you want to. But The Overnight, you got to go to the movie theater. So anyway, let's get into my conversation with this lovely guy. While we're talking, early on in the conversation, Patrick. Oh, and I should mention, Patrick heard my show with Jason Schwartzman a couple weeks ago. And really dug it, and he was really appreciated how I was kind of getting behind the film, and so he said, yeah, let's definitely get together. So it all worked out real well and came together really quickly. And during the conversation, we get a visitor, and it's brief but it's fun. And so here you go. This is the conversation with filmmaker Patrick Bryce. Again, it's The Overnight and Creep, both films.
All right, we are leaving the flatlands, and we are heading up towards the mountaintop. The ad said $1,000 for the day, filming services. Discretion is appreciated.
The yellow door. I'm realizing that no one knows I'm here.
Hi!
Shit. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to scare you.
I'm assuming you're Aaron.
Yeah. Aaron, nice to meet you.
Joseph. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. This is going to be a good day.
Before you turn on the mics.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Well, I always listen to how Marin does it. You know, Mark Marin.
Never heard of him.
No? You're familiar with him? He's a podcaster?
Just some gin?
Yeah.
Sure.
But, you know, he starts the conversation and doesn't tell people that he's recording them.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of, like, tricks, you know, where you can just sort of feel comfortable starting. Once you hit the, like, clapboard, you know, you have to have – that's actually a talent in of itself, is not to, like, freeze up and get all self-conscious, right? Because, you're ideally not – you want somebody to be at ease.
Right.
So it's easier just to, you know, hit the ground running.
Well, especially when you have all this intimidating accoutrement attached to you.
I know. It's better to get smaller and smaller. And I don't usually use this, but I was thinking I might have to refer to something, you know, or a press release or something.
Sure.
I've seen both films. We're talking about, of course, The Overnight and Creep, which is astounding that you were able to do both of these films. How much time in between? I assume there was a fair period of time here.
Yeah, no, I mean, you know,
even though they're coming out at the same time.
No, what's I mean, yeah, what's crazy is this is like the last 5 years of my life kind of being dumped out into the world the same weekend, essentially, you know. I think we shot Creep in February of 2012, and then we finished it sometime in 2013, and it was around the time.
Okay.
Yeah. So it was around the time we were finishing that up that I started writing The Overnight.
Can you talk about why the, I guess, the premiering it was delayed?
Yeah, no, it, well...
Because of The Overnight, or...?
No, I mean, it's because of the way in which we made Creep, because Creep, you know, we originally went out to make this kind of low-key, like, indie black comedy called Peach Fuzz, and that was the initial idea, and we went out and made this movie about this kind of it was almost about like an unlikely friendship developing, you know. And we cut that together and then started showing that to friends, and it just wasn't working, and we ended up showing it to Jason Blum from Blumhouse, who was friends with Mark at the time, and he was just like, guys, this is a horror movie. I'm sorry, I'm distracted because Jason Schwartzman is walking in here.
Oh, no, not him.
Has your voice recovered?
Hi, Jason. Hello again.
No. Are you okay?
It's all right. I'm on.
Say hi.
I'm taking steroids.
What happened?
Huh?
What happened?
Worse.
Yeah.
I'm on these steroids right now.
Okay. Okay. Don't talk.
Can you see that? See how many numbers that is? That's international.
That's international. That is.
You're about to 44. Make an international phone call.
No, so I'm already on.
Oh, okay. Well, say hello for us. Okay.
I listened to your podcast last week with him. It was quite funny. It was quite raucous.
It was. And this place is getting a little raucous too. It turns out, right?
Because I wanted to be in the loudest place possible.
It was so quiet when I showed up. But isn't it funny how in just like a week or so now it's like so casual? Like he came over and I could, you know,
you guys are best friends now.
Not quite, but
you have a shorthand.
There could be a variation on Creep
for sure.
You know, here I see some sort of Creep cool.
Absolutely. So we showed it to Jason Blum. Uh-huh. We showed Peach Fuzz to Jason Blum.
Okay.
And he was like, guys, this is a horror movie. Yes. You know, if you want to go back and sort of reverse engineer this, you know, by 15-20% and push this more into the genre world, I'll take it on as one of my films.
Right. Okay.
And so, you know, we said absolutely. You know, I mean, the bottom line for me going into this movie was just it was like a amorphous experiment going into it.
And you just went with it. You were
That's
good. That's a good skill to be able to just, you know, go with the momentum that's building and get out of the way in a way, you know, a little bit too. So you created this idea with Mark Duplass for this film, right? And you play
Aaron.
Aaron, that's right. You were the actor in it.
Yes.
And that saved you a little money too.
Yeah.
We
saved a lot of money.
Jason talked about your laugh. Got a little just a tiny flavor up there. Yeah. Anyway, so you and you're basically seeing an ad in the paper. Where is this, in Southern California? I forget where it is.
In Los Angeles.
In Los Angeles. Okay. Yeah. And you respond to this is the synopsis, and you can jump in if you want to.
Sure. Right?
And it's like $1,000 to come and shoot this guy. You really don't know too much more. Tells you where to go, and you show up in this house, sort of off the beaten trail. Beautiful home, right? House, and then we meet Mark Duplass's character.
Yes.
And remind me again of the
name. His name's Joseph with an F at the end.
Joseph, of course.
Yosef.
And he asks you to shoot and tell me how much of a spoiler. Take it from there, then I don't have to take responsibility for it.
For sure. Now, he's inspired by the film My Life with Michael Keaton. Just a classic.
It is
just
a classic
of early 90s saccharine bullshit cinema. Actually written and directed by the writer of Jacob's Ladder, which is one of my favorite movies.
Which is a great movie.
Oh,
It's so good.
It's one of the scariest movies I...
No, it is that movie is scary to the core, man. Yeah. There are moments in that movie that just... I can't watch. Yeah. I just can't watch. But it's also, like, oddly touching, you know?
It is. Yeah. Well, he's such a, you know, a damaged guy in that movie.
Yeah.
You know,
No, and that's a movie that also, like, I'm so... Like, I love how it's able to kind of subvert genre and actually do this kind of, like, sweet, emotional thing. And almost, you know, the spiritual journey and also a horror movie at the same time,
yeah.
You know. Anyway, so his character hires my character to film him for the day. And then the day goes on and things sort of devolve into a darker and darker experience where you basically are realizing that Mark's character is a psychopath.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, it's that's not giving anything away.
No.
We know that. So the
movie's called
the
Creep.
Truth is,
so
is,
you know.
Yeah. Yeah. It's true. Not Peach Fuzz.
No.
Yeah. And so it's just a matter of getting to how deep are we going to go here? You know.
Yeah.
How you know, we don't know how deeply we're going to get into Joseph's his mind.
Well, I mean, what's crazy about the movie and. I it's something I forget and then remember every time I have to see it again is just like what a claustrophobic experience it is.
Right.
Like you really have to, you know, like Mark Duplass, or not like, but appreciate him as a performer in order to like the movie because you are watching him the entire movie.
Right. And it's not a Mark you see. Have you seen before?
No.
Or really since. I don't think he's done. I'm kind of quickly going through my mind his
He hasn't really been a bad guy.
No.
No, and it was fun to be able to play with his charm, I guess, at the same time.
Right, and that earnest streak. He does earnest pretty well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, and I'm so grateful that this movie's going out in the world, but I'm also just in complete disbelief of the fact that it's going out in the world.
Right,
just because it feels like I was filming, it was like a performance art piece or something, you know? And like the takes are really long and there's like all these uncomfortable silences and, you know, it's just like...
It's uncomfortable almost from the beginning.
Yeah.
So be ready.
Yeah.
If you like that kind of movie where you're uncomfortable and
But horror fans are fucking masochists, man.
Yeah, that's true.
They
yeah.
love that feeling. They just give it to me. You know?
And you do. You give it to them,
yeah.
Patrick. Okay, Creep opens.
It'll be out on iTunes, actually.
Creep
comes out on iTunes.
So you're not doing a theatrical in New York?
We're not doing a theatrical in New York.
All right, I'm going to rephrase.
Yeah.
And then that's a good thing. I'm kind of excited about that idea. Creep is going to be coming out on demand, so on iTunes specifically?
Yes. iTunes, it'll be out on iTunes for a month on the starting the 23rd of June.
Okay.
And then it'll be out on Netflix worldwide the following month.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, Netflix actually...
It's the blue chip digital release,
yeah,
isn't it?
It's a new, it's a new thing. I don't know. I'm excited about it. I mean, I'm lucky because my other movie's coming out in movie theaters. So
right,
like
and we want to get to that in a minute because that's like... just before we skip over to The Overnight, which I'm excited to do because I love that movie, as you know. Were you in part of the conversation to decide to, at least in New York, forego a theatrical, which, you know, I think is actually bold and pioneering in a way? I don't know if it was meant to be that, but it's sort of a, you know, sort of an incidental aspect of that decision.
Yeah, no, I mean, there was a moment where we were going to have a theatrical, and I'm glad. I think it's, you know, part of which is just the way things shook out with how The Overnight's being released. Mm-hmm. You know, I think once we set a date for The Overnight and while we were still in Sundance, basically, it meant that Creep was going to be coming out after The Overnight. So it already felt weird that my first movie was coming out after my second movie. And then to have a big to-do about it, it felt like too much. So I'm glad that people will discover The Overnight and then Creep will be this kind of weird thing that they can find on their own, you know?
Sure. Yeah. It almost fits with the type of the smallness of the film in a way that it'll find this very particular audience that it should be paired with.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? And people have to kind of discover
it. It's also a different movie if you watch it in a movie theater or if you watch it at home.
Uh-huh.
You know, and it's, I mean, that's the other thing about it is like it's quite a darker experience watching it at home by yourself or with one other person, you know?
Yeah.
So I hope that doesn't affect, you know, how people feel about it too much. But it's, I mean, it's because it's a fun movie to watch in the theater, but it's less fun and a little more.
Yeah. So where did it premiered where?
South by Southwest South by, it was last South. Year. Yeah.
Okay. But it's interesting because, well, we'll make sure that this podcast goes up after the 23rd, I suppose. Well, wait, it's when fine. Does The Overnight come out? On the
comes out this weekend.
This weekend, no.
In New York and L.A. this weekend.
All right, so I feel compelled to put this show up as soon ASAP. But and The Overnight, as far as a demand, for is that happening right away, or is that going to be in a couple months? Or
on demand?
Yeah, you know, going out.
Oh,
on,
no,
on
yeah, it's, no, right? It's not. It's not there's, day and date. It's,
okay, very good.
What other? What's the word? I forget.
Right, tiered or some sort of.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. You can tell we're hip. Hip no. Guys.
Yeah, that's right. I should know the expression, but it's part of my charm. Yeah. So the Overnight's coming out this weekend, which is on the 19th?
Yes.
June. That makes sense. Friday, June 19th. So I'm going to put this up, and Overnight will be in theaters when this plays. And if the Creep is not available, it will be any second. So, but I like to put things up when people can actually then switch over after sure. They listen right to iTunes and watch it.
That'd be amazing.
Because they want to see Patrick Bryce and Mark Duplass in A House in the Woods. And you two are like the other than a couple of voices, maybe you guys are the only film guys in the film, right? You're the only people.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah. No, it's a like super contained thing.
Very contained, which is part of the claustrophobic nature that you were kind of referring to in a way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's get into The Overnight. Sure. Did you write this?
Yeah.
Oh, you did. Did you have some sort of experience that was sort of at least inspired The Overnight, or what? How did you come up with this great idea?
Yeah. I mean, the idea kind of came once again out of just thinking about the film as a production model and, you know, knowing we only had a certain amount of money to make it and then going from there in terms of saying, okay, well, I only have this amount of money, so I can only set it in one location and maybe two.
Nobody thinks about that, though, when they're watching. If the movie's good, nobody thinks about it. But I did ask
right.
You.
Yeah, I mean, and I know this is like, I mean, if it's in saying it like out loud almost sounds like the most uninspired. Like, I always thought I would be the type of filmmaker that would just be, you know, would pick a milieu or, you know, have a bunch of, you know, have a mood board and have some images up and, you know,
right. Yeah, yeah.
And you know, be watching all my favorite films over and over again to try to gain inspiration. But when it comes down to it, you know, when you're writing, you're just creating problems for yourself that you're going to be solving. And so it really helps you to be looking at it practically
yeah,
from the get-go.
Of course. I was thinking about those things, having talked to so many filmmakers.
Yeah.
They always learn this stuff for their second and third scripts, like, you yeah. know, tricks of how to keep the budget low from the beginning or keep within the realistic budget.
Yeah. No, I don't know. Like, I'm interested in a lot of shit. So in terms of interjecting characters and moments and scenarios like that, all that stuff is like... Like, all that stuff can come to me, but it's helpful when that comes to me when there's a framework attached to it from the get-go, you know. Mm-hmm. So with this, it was like, okay, we have a house, we only have four characters, you know, let's set it in one night and what can happen. And, you know, this was still, you know, Mark Duplass having conversations with me and just trying to come up with the, you know, initial seed of the movie. And we started talking about, like, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf and these movies that sort of take mm-hmm. place in one night.
Yeah,
you know?
Well,
and,
that makes sense.
And we were talking about sex and making a movie about sex. And, you know, I hadn't really seen a movie that dealt with sex in this way, especially that was, like, a comedy and then also, like, that had such, like, kind of broad, like, moments that you'd see in, like, a Farrelly Brothers movie or something,
right.
You know?
Yeah.
But then at the same time, I wanted it to have kind of a darkness to it, and I wanted it to feel real.
Yeah, like know? A rawness to the emotional side of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
And, like, yeah, and then, like, so there's a sort of casualness to the performances too that I like and was something I wanted to kind of play with, basically. Yeah.
I mean, you said you heard my conversation with Jason, so you know, like, you heard me talking about some issues that I think guys are, you know, I think because it's even though it explores lots of things like marriage and relationships, how to keep things alive and how to be honest and talk about uncomfortable things in the relationships, which it doesn't always get easier in a relationship. Sometimes it gets harder.
Sure.
Those just even admitting those types of things is pretty, I think, it's refreshing to hear it, let alone the very specifics of people's, you know, anxieties and sexual anxieties and
inadequacy.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, first and foremost, I wanted it to be an entertaining film. You know, yeah. I just, that's my goal always as a filmmaker. And at the same time, if it could be something that maybe
presented a model of self-acceptance that people, you know, even if that's like a subconscious thing, I hope that is something that seeps through when people are watching it. I don't know, you know. Mm-hmm. But, it, you know, for me, it was a chance to play with it, first of all, it was a chance to just kind of embrace a genre that I've always wanted to work in before, which is comedy. Like, I always wanted to make comedy. It's yeah. probably my favorite thing to watch when it comes to watching stuff. And mm-hmm. so it was just, yeah, it was
like Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? And
right. No, I mean, yeah, no.
I'm teasing. I was thinking of this when you mentioned that a few minutes ago, that watching the film, even as that's pretty dark and tension-filled as Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, but there's a lot you can learn from how they structured that film and yeah. the, you know, from that you could take into your film.
Yeah.
Since you're doing a, you know, since it's primarily a set piece and, or, you know.
I always love the build-up.
Yeah.
You know, it's so funny because, like, you know, I was thinking about Jurassic Park the other day, and my favorite part of Jurassic Park is all the, everything leading up to when shit starts to go haywire.
Or Jaws.
You know?
Jaws, same thing.
Yeah, exactly.
It's that leading up to the first time you see it. It's all that tension that's being built. And
it's always my favorite part of a movie. And I always get disappointed, especially with movies that are like, you know, action movies or, you know, yeah. You know, thrillers that might have these bigger set pieces that jump right into that. Like, I want to ease into it, you know? And even so, like, you know, if you're not going to ease into it, like, if make that first set piece its own thing. Like, I was thinking about the Brian De Palma Mission Impossible. I watched that again the other day. And have you seen that?
I saw it when it came out. It's yeah. been so long, I can't remember.
It's, I mean, you should watch it again because okay. structurally it's so different than most, like, than any, I mean, especially any movie that's coming out nowadays based on a TV show or something, you know? Because, right. I mean, I think it was Robert Towne wrote it, and you got Town and De Palma making wow. a remake of a TV show, and it, you know, the first 15 minutes are like almost a short film in and of itself. It's mm-hmm. the, you know, their first mission, and there's a whole arc in the first 15 yeah. minutes of the movie, and then they keep going, you know. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. Yeah, there is something fun about, you know, drawing out that tension. And I mean, man, I learned so much about narrative tension making Creep. Like, it was a real clinical process making mm-hmm. that movie, because, you know, we had like 7 reshoots for that movie over the course of a year. Mark Duplass and I would test the movie, you know, dial in what moments needed to be corrected, and
really?
Then go back and reshoot those moments because we could, because there we didn't have a crew or anything, and it was just us.
Wow.
And so
right.
it, you know,
yeah,
like our responsibility, you know, was our own in terms of making the movie work or not. And we had the chance, we constantly found ourselves having the chance to make the movie 5% better and 5% better, or
yeah,
work
yeah,
a little
yeah,
bit
sure.
more, you know?
Sure, sure.
So that was like a crash course in just figuring that stuff out.
I just can't imagine with all the guys, one of the busiest people. I mean, it's so productive.
Oh,
so.
Yeah. No, we were doing that in between when yeah. he was, like, going to shoot The Lazarus Effect, or, you know, doing The League. Like, he would,
yeah.
you know, shoot a week on The League, and then, okay, we got to go back up to the cabin in Crestline to reshoot this jump scare moment, you
yeah.
know, in the movie. Like, it was crazy. But I'm so grateful that, you know, we sort of both just kind of gave into the movie and let the movie be what it was wanting to be.
It sounds like, you know, going to school. Like getting a degree or something.
Oh, it was,
by the end of
no,
the,
it was
know.
Like a workshop.
Yeah,
it was like
yeah.
it was. And I was thinking about that. Like, how can I make this a workshop for film students? Because it's one of those things where
you could do a master class based on the making of Creep. You know,
I guess. I mean, if people like it, you know, I think one of the things that hopefully, film school is about, like, you know, best case scenario, discovering what kind of filmmaker you should be. Like, mm-hmm. you go in with the idea of what kind of filmmaker you're going to be, and you hopefully will come out of that knowing what you should be doing, you know? At least that was for me. Like, I was open to that change.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Because when I was in school, I was making documentaries. Like, my thesis film from school, which is, you know, Mark saw and was one of the reasons why we started working together. Like, that was, like, I thought I was going to be making docs, like Verite docs.
Yeah, right. I understand.
It is a party in here.
Yeah, well, we're at the Bowery Hotel, so you hear the hum of the various guests.
Just lots of cool people. There's lots
very
of cool people.
Very hip. Yeah, very hip people. I'm definitely feeling slightly out of place here. I'll scooch in a little closer because I tend to forget, since I'm listening
yeah.
to both of us on the headphones.
Does it sound good, though? Is
yeah.
The,
it no, sound, it does
It sounds
sound
like
good.
We've added these people, right?
I have to capture that to be able to... I don't know.
There's a hip-hop station in L.A. that... always has crowd noise behind the DJ in between.
Oh, really?
So it sounds like they're at a block party all the time. And it was like my wife pointed out to me the other day that it's the same crowd noise every. It's like fake canned.
Right. Yes. Know? Yeah. 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 Sampled crowd noise. Well, I was going to just mention one other thing to. I know we're kind of flip-flopping a little bit, but sure. To go back to The Overnight. Also, it's nice to see a case where, especially in comedies nowadays, and a lot of male-centric, although I guess I'm going to already correct myself that the tide seems to be changing, that there are better comedic roles. I understand a spy is supposed to be really good. But, you know, you don't see a lot of comedies where, I guess, the guys and the ladies are all written fully. You know what I mean? Like, sure. Like you would think maybe a few years back seeing Jason Schwartzman in The Overnight with Adam Scott or Adam Scott. You know, and then it would be, you know, Taylor Schilling and Judith Goldreich. What's her name?
Godrech. Yeah, yeah, you got Godrech, it. Godrech. You got it.
Pardon, je parle français. No. She's a French actress, but anyway, they're the wives and or girlfriends. I forget.
Wives.
Right, wives, definitely. But they have their own scenes that are as fully fleshed out, realized as the men do in this, and their issues are explored as much as the guys are here.
Yeah.
So it really is a very even playing field, you know, with all four characters.
Yeah.
And like you said, again, you don't see that too often in comedies.
Sure.
You might see in Virginia Woolf, but...
Yeah, well, I think only now is there, like, sort of a reaction to that. You're starting to see a reaction to that in comedy, you know?
I think,
because
right.
there is this, like, archetype of, like, the wife is the nag, or the wife...
Puts up with the husband's shenanigans, rolls the eyes.
Right.
But it's always there.
Right. And, yeah. Oh, yeah, and, like, and that's... And I knew that it was going to be touchy with that, with this movie, because, you know, Taylor's character is kind of meant to be an anchor for the audience, and she does have to say stuff like, should we leave? Things are starting to get strange, you know?
Right. She becomes the avatar, as it were,
in
a way.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was worried about that, and I think Taylor was conscious of that going into it, too, you know? And so, you know, we had conversations, and, you know, basically both of us understood that we didn't want that to be the case with her, and we really wanted her to be a fully formed character and to have her own journey that she's going on. And I thought, you know, in terms of the way the movie ends up, it was going to be really important. You know, she was the one that was going to need to be won over in this situation for
right.
the audience
yeah.
to be believing it. There's Miss Judith.
Oh, there
Godrech.
She is. Oh, my goodness. How are you? Ça va? Ça va? Très jolie. She's very lovely.
Just attractive people floating in and out of this
yeah,
place.
That's right. The actress Judith Godrech. I've seen her in other films.
Oh, yeah.
Where they all speak French, oddly enough.
Yeah.
I don't understand it.
No, I remember her from L'Auberge Espagnole.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, sure. Oh, that's where it is. Yes, of course. Well, I saw that whole cycle of films. I saw all three. There's Russian Dolls and Chinese Puzzle. Did you know that?
I haven't seen that one, no. Oh,
well, sorry. No, that's the... Well, it was just a trilogy of films.
Oh, no.
Where they each take place in a different city around the... Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Now, the Russian
director?
Dolls doesn't... Yeah, I'm pretty sure I know it.
I don't remember the director.
But it's that skinny French actor is the star, right? What's his, Jeremy something?
Right, yeah.
I like French films.
You remember her in Ridicule, too? Did you see Ridicule?
I must have seen it. I don't know.
She's,
I'm not sure.
I remember Ridicule because of the box cover, because the box cover is like... just Judith, basically. Like she's
very good.
She's one of three or four leads, but the box cover is like her with her bosom prominently displayed. And
no problems.
Yeah, no.
That's not even sexist thing to say. No. It's really just.
It's just really
she's French.
It's really Miramax in 1996. That's what that is.
Well, she looks too young to be
Harvey.
A lead in
Harvey Weinstein saying, I want some boobs. I want to
sell some DVDs or VHS.
Yeah,
VHS. Well, I have so much I want to ask you about. Not that we've been interrupted yet, but I have to imagine. What would they say to us?
We can keep the wolves at bay here.
Huh. I like that. Did you go to... You mentioned film school. So did you,
yeah.
you went to film school? Did you go in L.A.? Or?
I went to CalArts.
CalArts?
L.A.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
I went there for a year and a half. I was a transfer student.
Oh, okay.
I had...
Where'd you grow up?
In Northern California.
Northern California.
Yeah, I grew up in Nevada City, California.
Okay.
Grass Valley. It's like a small gold mining town up in the foothills.
Uh-huh.
It's like 10,000 people.
So your people are mining folk?
No. It's funny. It's kidding. Like the town is a weird mix of hippies, like Back to the Landers.
Yeah,
like
sure.
the poet Gary Snyder lives up there and stuff. And
okay.
then like straight up rednecks.
A lot of, yeah, I understand. Sure. Well, that's usually the case. A lot of the people from maybe from after maybe the heyday, which was pretty short in the 60s, San Francisco, before it got very druggy. I'm sure a lot of those folks, maybe they left the city and moved north. I don't know. I'm guessing.
Yeah, but, no, for sure.
A lot of them got really dark and ugly because the drugs got darker and uglier.
Absolutely. And then it became a tourist trap, the old Haight-Ashbury. So I was a child of hippies, basically, living up there. My mom still lives up there in the middle of the woods.
Oh, yeah.
And then I lived in the Bay Area for 8 years and was on the 8-year track in community college.
I know that one.
I wanted to finish my BA, and my then girlfriend, now wife, had just graduated Berkeley, and so I applied to CalArts, and it's a really crazy school. It's super, you know, it's like heavily involved in conceptual art and great music, and then like great animation program.
And that is maybe why initially you were figuring you were going to be a serious, not that you're not a serious filmmaker, but, you know, in your terms.
I'm not a serious filmmaker. No. Well,
you're making comedies and horror genre films, which, you know, is perfect for today anyway, because people, they're very popular, and the best is yet to come, I assume.
I'm the only one out of my graduating class that's making genre. No one else is doing that. Like most people are making stuff that's playing in festivals or gallery stuff, you know.
Well, The Overnight played at least one festival that I've heard of, which is Sundance, where it premiered. That's incredible. In The Overnight, right? So, but that was great, getting into Sundance.
Yeah. No, it was, I mean, I thought that was the tip of the iceberg. So everything that's happened after that, the fact that the movie sold, the fact that it played all these other festivals, the fact that we're getting a theatrical release, this is all just like more layers of icing on the cake. Like I'm waiting for the other shoe to drop at any moment. That's just my just MO, casting. You know.
It's a good one. No, I understand. They can't ever fall too hard then. But casting Jason Schwartzman is these days, it's like as close as you can get to a sure thing.
Yeah.
You know, as far as striking the ball out of the park, because he's just such a – he can tune his performance, just he calibrates accordingly, you know?
Yeah. No, if Bob Byington can do it, anyone can do it. That's what I always say.
Yeah.
I just had to give him a shout out because I know he listens to your show. So,
oh well, maybe not after this last week. Because I was realizing I'm not talking about Seven Chinese Brothers enough, probably, and pissing him off is my guess. But I can't be
Bob's
sure.
Bob's an easy guy to piss off, though.
Maybe so.
But he's also a love at the same time. But Jason is like, as a performer, he's one of the. I mean, he's one of the most generous actors I've ever worked with. Period. You know, he is so completely focused and intuitive, and just like that dude can. I mean, he can do anything, and especially in this kind of world, and giving him a role like Kurt in our movie, like it was just, you know, he just took it and ran with it. It's crazy.
He's so good in it. Did you know his mother was in Rocky?
Yeah. I love it.
What's so funny is Horner was like, just asking, I'm like, you're not going to ask anything about The Godfather? Of course,
I loved it because it was like he had a set, like a list of questions, like ready, his Jason Schwartzman questions ready to go. And
what's
just
so good
like,
about
bam,
that is
bam, bam.
I feel beholden to talk about the film, to talk about filmmaking. To talk about, so if I have you on or Jason on, I feel like I need to talk about plugging the project only, but I feel like I want to talk about, you know, like the journey and that and the process and the process. You know? But Orner was great because, and I would love him to always be at my side because he'll just go right for the fun. And I'm a little felt like if I have Jason on. Of course, I want to, like, you know, your mother, like, who when you were, did like Brando come over? I'm curious to know.
But Jason's like, I mean, he's someone that, I mean, obviously you want to be like respectful and stuff, but like he's someone that you could just ask any of those questions. He's happy to answer them. He's just such an open. That's just how he exists. When he showed up to set the first day, he brought vegan cupcakes for the entire crew. You know, it's just like,
as opposed to like roast beef cupcakes,
right? Yeah, I don't know what makes a vegan. I guess if you don't use egg.
No dairy products in it. Yeah. terrific. To remind everybody again, let's see, the Overnight is in theaters as of Friday, June 19th, and Creep is going to be on demand as of on iTunes specifically for a month, starting the 23rd of June, and then eventually on Netflix, and perhaps elsewhere. I don't know. And what's next for Patrick? What's
I'm gonna take a long nap.
That's probably deserved
in July. Okay. Yeah, no, I mean it's crazy. You know, I know this part of the
process. Catch up on some movies.
Yeah, I would. God, watching a movie, sitting and watching a movie in the theater. That sounds so far away from me right now. I haven't been able to do that, and I had to.
It's because people are probably so annoyed at you because you probably can never go to a theater and enjoy yourself because you're so tall.
Right. Well, it's all leg, so no, you know, I don't really have to worry about people behind me being pissed off. It's mostly me pissing everyone else off because I hate it when people talk or text or do anything other than watch a movie or sit right next to me in a movie theater. So I'm just like my wife, like it's getting to the point where she won't come see movies with me because I'm such a policeman when it comes to that stuff. But yeah, I was funny. I was like thinking about it. I haven't watched a movie in a movie theater, I think, in almost 2 months. Besides San Andreas, which I had to review for Nick Dawson's website.
Oh, the Talkhouse.
Yeah. Which, like, having only seen that movie in the movie, and, like, I forget that good movies exist, basically. Like, that just kind of completely clouded everything else, you know?
Yeah. Well, you maybe you don't block people so much, because maybe, as you say, you're... upper half is, or your torso isn't as long.
I'm a sloucher too.
And you slouch. But your legs are long, so therefore you also have to, they're uncomfortable maybe in like flights and on in
movie theaters. It's the worst. No, I mean that's like a whole, we could do a whole nother podcast. Just
let's do it.
How about that?
Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah. About the aisle.
I have to go exit row. I have to. I always make
thank
a
God for that.
I plead for it. I kind of do a little dance, you know, if I haven't been already assigned it for the person at the front desk trying to get me switched. But I lose. It's a circulation thing too.
Oh, I get it. No, I can understand that. Sure.
Yeah.
It's a nightmare.
Jesus.
We did end up doing another podcast.
In a very serious way.
This is what happens. I'm a dad. I become very...
Oh, yeah. You're a sensitive guy.
I'm a sensitive... Exactly. I'm empathetic.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm very excited that we got to do this. I was really looking forward to it because I was caught off guard. I had heard good things, but when I went to it, saw it at Tribeca.
Oh,
but
fantastic.
I really had a great time seeing the Overnight. And then, you know, I just like the whole vibe of what you're doing. So thanks for being so, you know, amenable and everything.
Thanks. I've been listening to your show. You had Bob on, but then you also had my friend Brandon Colvin on.
Oh.
Brandon made Sabbatical.
Yeah, yeah, of course. With Robert Longstreet.
Yeah.
Did you listen to that one?
Yeah, I did.
Did you listen? You listened to the Longstreet one too?
No, I did. No, I listened to Brandon and Colvin. Tony. Yeah.
Oh yes, right. Well, they had the right. Yeah, the Wisconsin Brandon.
I love Robert Longstreet so much. I tried to get him to be in this, and he wouldn't do it. Massage parlor scene.
Oh, right. To be the guy?
I tried to get him to be the guy.
Oh, that would have been perfect for
him.
This
is an exclusive for you, by the way.
Calling out. Well, I'm sure Robert is listening, too. You got to track down that episode. That's people are always talking about the Robert Longstreet episode. I like that's a very nice thing whenever somebody mentions that. But you'll really like that episode.
That guy, man, he's just a true supporter of indie movies and young people trying to make shit. I mean, just a completely compelling performer to watch. Just his genuine spirit is just one of a kind. It's crazy.
Robert, if you're listening, obviously you have a role in the next Patrick.
Yeah, no, I mean, we've talked about it. I'd love to.
Sure.
I'd love to. I'm a little intimidated by him at the same time, but, you know.
Not once you meet him. Well, thanks so much. And then we'll do this again.
Sounds great.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Patrick.
If you're uncomfortable, you don't have to do anything you don't want to.
Okay.
Hello. You new around here?
We just moved here from Seattle.
Well, welcome.
Thank you.
Wow. Max has really taken a shine to your boy. Tonight is our regular pizza night. We could turn it into a welcome the neighborhood get-together.
Huh.
It could be fun. Going to Whole Foods now. Any dietary restrictions?
I don't think so.
Screw it. You guys, I'm so excited. Yay!
All right.
Whoa.
Oh, wow.
Thank you for having us in
your
beautiful home.
Glad you can be of service.
Why don't we put the kids to bed upstairs and continue down here?
Oh.
Give me 20 minutes and I will give you parental bliss.
My name is Jason Schwartzman. You're listening to Film Wax Radio. I'm having a great time.
Okay, I read this book, Orson Welles' last movie. I enjoyed it thoroughly. This author is very talented. This is we got to bring up the Indiegogo page now. So if you go to Indiegogo, do yourself a favor, try this right now as you listen to the show if you have the option, and we're going to go to Indiegogo, and then I'm going to search under "Other Side of the Wind" because that's the name of his last movie that he never finished. And everyone's trying to raise money to finish this film finally. It's supposed to be incredible. Search under Orson Welles' last film, or you can search under Other Side of the Wind, The Other Side of the Wind, and it will come up. And, okay, they're trying to raise $1 million. The campaign is very much winding down. The good thing about Indiegogo is you get to keep whatever you make. You don't have to return it. So, like Kickstarter, you set a benchmark, let's say $1 million. I mean, that's pretty high obviously for Kickstarter. Not many people have done that. And if you don't make it all gets returned to those people who have set it. Right now, they're just under $270,000. So they're creeping up towards one third of the way to their goal, which is, I still think, impressive. It's not enough, probably, to do what they need to do, but there's only about a week and a half left. So you can go to Indiegogo.com and, again, search under Other Side of the Wind or Orson Welles' final film, and you will come up with this, and you can check it out. There is on their page, and the campaign ends Independence Day weekend some point. Anyway, but if you donate, for instance, $75, you get a great Orson Welles T-shirt. $100, you get a Maverick T-shirt and a digital copy of the film. All right, well, so it looks great. And there's all sorts of videos on here of Orson Welles accepting the AFI speech where he accepted the special award. For $1,000, you get special custom cigars. He was a big cigar smoker, right? So there you go. So let's talk to the author who wrote a book about this, the whole story behind the making of this legendary film, The Other Side of the Wind. Again, never been out. So let's see if we can help in our little way. Here we go. Let's go talk to author Josh Karp.
All right, we on?
We're on.
Okay.
Hello?
Do you want to go?
Okay, yes, you go first.
All right. I'm Noah Baumbach.
I'm Wes Anderson.
And
we're gathered here to talk with you about the campaign to raise the money for The Other Side of the Wind.
Yeah, yeah, and how important this is, and you just got to do it. It's Orson Welles.
It's Orson Welles. You probably know how important Orson Welles is to the history of the movies. One of the great masters.
And if you don't, just Netflix them and then give money.
And then they give the money after that.
You can read all about this. It's his last movie. It was never finished. You just got to do it.
You just got to do it. Peter Bogdanovich is overseeing the completion, the restoration,
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And Peter's in the movie. He was great friends with Orson. This is the way to do it.
It stars John Huston, who plays an Orson Welles-esque movie director, so that sounds very interesting right off the bat.
Yeah, I mean, I would do it even if I didn't know Orson Welles made it, and John Huston was just playing an Orson Welles-type movie director. And then it also has Peter Bogdanovich in it.
Yes, so it's really got a lot of hooks that probably make it a must-see.
So you just got to do it.
Thank you.
Hey, Adam, how are you?
Good. How are you, Josh?
I'm good.
Great, great. Where are you?
Just north of Chicago. I'm in, where all the John Hughes movies are set, basically.
Oh, really? In the suburbs?
Yeah, you know, it's where Risky Business was set.
Oh, is that right?
Weirdly enough. All the John Hughes movies were kind of filmed either at the high school I went to for...
Did you cut classes and go join parades and drive convertibles?
You know, it's funny, my kids love watching Ferris Bueller all the time, and they think that that must have been what it was like, and that that's, like, what high school is like.
Uh-huh.
And I'm like, no, not on my watch. I'm like...
My experience was wholly, wholly different than that.
Yeah.
Then, what was your entry into your interest in film?
You know, I mean, I was always, like, a movie person. I mean, that was, even as a little kid, you know, I watched, you know, much... smaller selection than there is today, but I loved movies, you know, just as a general fan as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what was like a total movie slut. I mean, I would see anything and really kind of continued that way for quite a long time. And then, you know, as far as, you know, I've never been like a film scholar type, but I've always loved, you know, kind of old Hollywood.
Yes.
Biographies of old Hollywood people. You know, as a writer, I think I've always... wanted to write about people like that, and never. I've always been jealous when other people have taken the opportunity to do so,
mm-hmm.
because it's such a dwindling area. Because there are only, you know, at a certain point, there are only so many books that can be written about these folks, and there's, you know, really super. They don't make people like that, and that world.
No, they don't. You're right. Anymore. Larger than life. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so you know, people like that can't exist. So yeah, and I've always loved. That kind of thing. I mean, I you know read every biography of like Bogart and Spencer Tracy and Cary Grant and all those guys. Always with an enormous
The icons.
Always loved it and with a huge amount of jealousy.
Well, did you study writing or journalism? What was your way into writing, to becoming a writer?
I'm trying to think now how long ago it was. I did a couple things after college. I worked in advertising. I went to law school and I worked for my family's business. And when my family's business got sold. When I was in my late 20s, I had this kind of point where I was like, okay, if I'm going to be a writer, it's now. And so I went and got a master's degree in journalism at Northwestern. And that was, you know, that was my entry point into doing it. I think I needed the discipline and the training of that to really, you know, I would have never had any idea of how to make a living doing this if I had just jumped into it.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, so I did that, and I came out of Northwestern, and not intending to become a freelance magazine writer, but I wound up really quickly having more work than I knew what to do with through a bunch of different circumstances. Thankfully, that transitioned into other things, but it was great while it lasted. I mean, it was, you know, I think if one of the things I figured out was that if you can do good work, and if you can actually are interested in going after work rather than kind of wishing people would just bring you work, that made a big difference.
You also continue to teach at Northwestern?
Yeah, I mean, I took some time off to work on the book, and I taught a couple times while working on the book. I'm currently probably not teaching until the fall, but yeah, I teach magazine article writing, and I teach sometimes nonfiction book writing.
Very good. Well, speaking of nonfiction writing, this brings us to today and your recent the recent publication of your new book, Orson Welles' last movie, the making of The Other Side of the Wind, which I recently read. What an adventure story! It seems like from how you described your love of the old movie stars and you know just these larger than life characters that were actually real people. But they were also characters that you were able to take that and then sort of engage with it and create a book about it. Let me rephrase. You were able to take this passion and this love of yours that you have always had and finally write a book about it. So when did this idea of writing about this as yet unreleased film come about?
Yeah, I was I think I was halfway through my last book, and this was my third book, and my mm-hmm. experience is that about halfway through a book, I come to a point where I go, oh my God, this is not going to work, and I'm going to have to give the money back, and I'm going to be destroyed, and this is horrible, and what am I going to do? And at that point, I usually find some kind of distraction. And in this case, the distraction was a book. I'm not sure which one right now, but it was a book about Wells. And there were some other Side of the Wind stories in it. And one thing that was, you know, immediately apparent, I had heard about the movie over the years and read about it in various biographies and, you know, magazine articles and bits and places. And everything about the story was in bits and pieces. Nobody had even a remotely comprehensive version of this story. So I read a couple of the stories, and I'm quite certain that one of them was John Huston driving the car the wrong way on the highway.
Oh, right.
And I was like, oh my God, you know, and I was so screwed on the other book at the time, which I finally finished, but I was like, now if I could write about something like that, that would be fantastic. And then there was also one of the things I started doing a little bit of research on it because it was a good distraction. And the more and more I got into it, and there's Joe McBride's book, Whatever Happened to Orson Welles, does give a pretty good recounting of a lot of it and is a great book. And one of the things I found in there was this moment where in the middle, you know, 5 years into production, Welles was completely frustrated and screamed the old Hollywood line of, who do I have to fuck to get off this picture? And I remember thinking, he's the producer, he's the director, he's the writer. I was like, you know, and literally I thought to myself, oh, he's got to fuck himself. And
that should have been the name of the book.
Yeah, you know, I hate to say that was like the origin of the book, but I was like, that, you know, there's this whole way in which I felt like there was this circular,
yes,
but meaningful aspect to the story that was about more than just the making of an unfinished movie. And that kind of encompassed it, was this guy kind of trapped, you know, this incredible director trapped within his own creation.
Well, it's not quite an undoing, but it is a cycle of sorts where he's constantly getting caught in this ongoing cycle where he starts a project and then creates all sorts of fantasies almost about, like, you know, who's his friends, who are his enemies, and he has to create this drama, this tension. And, of course, it's all financially, you know, everything's precarious financially, and so it ends up kind of imploding on him, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, it's interesting. One of the things that was, you know, I really loved about the book was, you know, unless I'm missing something that's going to happen in the future, this was the most intelligent, most talented guy I'll ever write about.
Sure.
You know, just, I mean, an you know, and guy with incredible charm and with, you know, who possessed a level of creativity that is, you know, almost incomprehensible.
You know, and they're all like being really like being just abused by him on the set. One guy in the book said just to be looked at by Orson Welles, thought it was worth the whole time, you know?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, yeah, that was a huge thing. I mean, he drew these people in, and people, person after person said to me that, you know, nothing mattered except, A, that you were around Orson Welles. And not because he was, you know, Orson Welles, the big celebrity, but because he was Orson Welles, the filmmaker. So it was important to be around him, and it was also important to help him do something. That seemed like such a worthy endeavor to people. Mm-hmm. And a compelling endeavor, something that they almost couldn't pull themselves away from. And he was great with all that stuff. And what was stunning to me was, and I learned after a while that it was a little bit too much of an expectation to think that it would be otherwise, but that a guy that smart and that talented could have such blind spots about his own behavior. And then I kind of learned that he really saw and accepted his own behavior after a fashion. He knew how bad he was with money. He knew how bad he was at picking partners. It didn't stop him. But there was a great line where he said something about having always had the worst taste in business partners. You're always picking someone who was about to go bankrupt, or someone who was going to rob him, or someone who was going to do the one thing that would set him off completely. And he said to somebody, you know, I get it. I'm like the guy who every time he walks out of the house gets struck by lightning. And at a certain point you start to think, perhaps this is not the lightning's fault. And, you know, so he saw it. He knew. But he couldn't control that aspect of his life. And I kind of gave up the expectation after a while. At first I was like, he's so smart. How can he not see this? And then I thought, okay, he sees it. He can't control it. Just like, you know, people who are alcoholics can't control that sometimes. And, you know, I can't control in the middle of the night. You know, there's, we all have things we can't control. And he would be perfect if he didn't do those things.
Mm. I don't know what your age is, but...
I'm 48.
Okay, very good. So we're close in age. And so by the time you and I, when Orson Welles was on air, when we started seeing him, and, you know, he was kind of washed up in the as we, you know, for shorthand. And he, you know, he was doing talk shows and occasionally even game shows. He was doing commercials. So, you know, I think we even, it runs counter to this idea that even then he was still artistically vital. And even though he might have been his own worst enemy in some cases, he was still trying to get real, legitimate artistic films made.
Right. Well, that's, I mean, you know, one of the interesting things about him is you've got the guy who's, you know, arguably the greatest film artist ever, and who, you know, when we were growing up, at the same time, was, you know, the world's, you know, most famous kind of pitch man who everybody thought, wow, he's really beneath himself doing all these things. Why would such a great man be doing Parmesan wine commercials? And so there was this huge dichotomy between the public perception of who this guy was and the reality of who he was as an artist. And I think he never, yeah, one of the really interesting things was he never stopped thinking of himself as a really viable artist. And he, you know, there's something actually really incredible about how hopeful he was in the making of this film. After all the things he'd been through, that he always kind of thought, with this movie and with others, but I think especially with this movie, that like, this is going to be the one that makes it all come back. And that, you know, gives me the career back, that gets me the money I don't have, and all those things.
There's always that, it's again, it's like this, I don't know, it's like this ongoing scratched record, you know what I mean? Like we all have this on some level where we keep setting ourselves up in this cycle that we can't kind of break from. But his was just on a spectacular level, that's all.
Everything he did was on a spectacular
that's
level.
That's very true. That's very true.
He couldn't... There's a great story from Henry Jaglom where his first movie had come out and they were having lunch together and Orson Welles was reading him the reviews of his movie. And Henry Jaglom said, you know, Orson, you know, I really appreciate you doing all of this, but, you know, I've read all these reviews. And Welles said, right, but you haven't heard me read them. And, you know, that was kind of his,
yeah.
You know, he was great at that. I mean, you know, he was like, he viewed his life in a lot of ways in certain moments as, you know, hey, I got to play Orson Welles. And, you know, yes, you've read those reviews, but you haven't heard them read to you by Orson Welles at this great, extraordinary, dramatic moment. And he did that. I mean, he was, you know, this movie, one of the really fascinating things is all these people who worked on it, I think even people who went on to achieve really great things, this is something they always remember. If they were there for a day, or if they were there for a month, or there for a week, being around him for any period of time was like a gigantic part of your life experience.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure. It's caught in the whirlwind.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
So it never got finished, and this is the year that Orson Welles would have turned 100. So
right.
There's been a lot of attention and retrospectives and that type of thing that's been going on around the country, probably around the world. And your book was nicely timed with that as well. What is the status of The Other Side of the Wind?
Well, you know, the film was... After 1976, things kind of, you know, he worked on the film for 6 years between 70 and 76. And it was funded by the Chavarons' brother-in-law primarily. And as the 70s wore on and trouble started in Iran, and Welles started feeling pressure from the Iranians, there was this, it became hopeless in some ways, even though they tried to finish it. the film got impounded in France under all kind of, under a strange French copyright law attached to it that really muddled who owned what. And by the time Wells died, it was really kind of stuck in this mess. And the mess got worse after he died because he left behind a not so tidy estate, and an extremely not tidy estate. I mean, it was everything you would expect his estate would be. It was just kind of a big mess that pitted people against each other and all kinds of stuff. So it was like under this curse almost, and people have tried to finish it innumerable times since Wells died. And Gary Graver, his cinematographer, really gave, you know, the next 20 years of his life to trying to get this movie finished. And all kinds of people had been involved over the years. And in fact, somebody had asked me, they said, when they did an article about the possible completion of the film in the New York Times last fall, the person who was writing the story said, she said, well, how many people have tried to finish this movie over the years? And I said, you know, I think I recount, you know, 10 or 12 in the book, but I can't give you a number because I know the second I say it's X number, the next day I'm going to start getting emails from people who say, oh, I tried to finish that movie.
Sure.
And sure enough, literally that thing was in the paper, and I got emails from three different people who claimed they had tried to finish the movie over the years. And so it's just this bizarre tale of, you know, that involves everything.
Right, and it's one that's taken on mythic proportion and has all...
Yeah, I
can see that. So I know that there was recently a crowdsource
fundraiser
to raise money to complete the film.
Yes. So what happened was that, yeah, in last fall, a group, including Frank Marshall, who, you know, giant producer who had worked on the film as a line producer, and a guy named Philip Janrimsa, who had been working on this for about 5 years, had kind of pulled all the rights together and gotten people to at least agree in principle and to let them try to finish the film. And so they were able to get this film out of a lab in Paris where it's been sitting untouched for more than 30 years, like 40 years. And what happened was now they tried to get a distributor, and to get the distributor, they had to cut together footage from the negative to show. And they needed to raise the money to get the distributor to give them the money. They needed to raise money to finish the film. Or not to finish the film, but to make something that they could show to distributors to get the money to really finish the film. So they wound up trying to raise funds through crowdsourcing through Indiegogo, and the campaign still goes on, and they're trying to raise $2 million.
Wow.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting because it, in a way, I mean, and they're great people, and they are, what they are doing is they're doing everything for the right reasons, and they're doing it, you know, trying to do it the right way. But what's been, you know, interesting and also sad is how it's really faces a lot of the same problems that Wells faced throughout his life. I mean, they haven't been able to raise so far the amount of money that they wanted to raise. And, you know, all these things that you think would go, you know, where you had this perfect timing. They announced it the day after Wells's 100th birthday and all these things. And it's, you know, really kind of, you know, been sad because they deserve better. And it's not $2 million is a lot of money, but it's not a lot of money in the scheme of things that way. Yeah, and I think they've struggled a bit, and I hope they're able to get it done because it's, they put a huge amount of effort into it. It would be great for the movie to be out in the world, and it's really, you know, it kind of still falls under, you know, until that happens, under this weird cursed tragedy of this film, like the film that couldn't get finished, that symbolizes all of the things that made Wells films fall apart financially.
Well, again, the book is called Orson Welles' Last Movie, The Making of The Other Side of the Wind, and the author we've been talking with is Josh Karp. Josh, do you have any other project now? I mean, you obviously need to get back and, like, return emails and clean the bathroom and do your laundry and all after, and I know you're probably back to teaching, but do you have another idea in mind for your next book?
You know, right now I'm actually, I'm trying to think of what to do for my next book, which I've not come upon yet, but I'm working on a TV pilot project, and also on a film version of the book. The book was acquired by Beach Hill Productions, and I'm working with Joe Infantolino, who is the producer there, on adapting the book into a feature film. So, which is really fun. I mean, I always thought, in a lot of ways, that, you know, and again, there's this bizarre irony of making a film about somebody making a film about somebody making a film. you know, and that then the, you know, that that's happening while they're still trying to finish the other film. But yeah, so I mean, but I always thought, even from the start, and when I was writing the book, I really thought I wanted to make the book was the story is such a cinematic story that I always kind of in the back of my mind hoped, you know, someday I'd be able to make it into a screenplay. So those are the two things I've been working on. I'm currently working on while I try to figure out what my next book is.
Well, I mean, it all sounds very exciting and all very worthwhile. And I'm so glad that we were able to manage to hook up and make this happen. So thanks for doing this.
Oh, yeah. Thank you so much, Adam. I appreciate you doing this.
Oh, my pleasure. You know, the book is available where books are sold or, you know.
Anywhere books are sold. And, you know, online and actual real bookstores and pretty much, yeah, everywhere. Thank you, Adam.
Thank you so much.
Okay, everybody, thanks so much. You've been listening to another episode of Film Wax Radio, episode number 301. I appreciate it. Please, please, please. This show is free, okay? It doesn't cost a dime. All you have to do is turn it on, and you'll get hundreds and hundreds of hours of entertainment and of interesting guests and all that. So please go to the iTunes page. It only takes a few seconds. Go to the iTunes page and give us a star rating. Leave a comment if you feel so inclined, please. That's all I ask. And you can go to our Facebook page, of course, facebook.com/filmwaxradio. We're on Twitter @filmwaxradio. Of course, we're on Instagram. So you know, you can engage with us. Okay. But most importantly of all, please go to that iTunes page and engage with that. It's important. If you're subscribed, you can put in a star rating, 1 through 5, and comments. They're very helpful, especially the star rating, because it moves the show up the ranks at iTunes podcasts area. So, and that's how people discover the show. All right. Well, I'm going to sign off real fast here because you guys have been very patient for a very long show. Thank you for listening. This podcast is presented by Rooftop Films. Thanks very much. Until next time.
What are some of your big regrets?
Big regrets? Oh, I suppose that I fell in love with movies. You know, you can fall in love with a girl and have her ruin your life. And I fell in love with movies, and I have done less in my life than I would have if I hadn't.
What would you have done had you not fallen in love with movies?
I don't know, but something that didn't take so much time and cost so much in money and energy and everything else. I can't change this condition of love. But I think I would be better off without it.
There's a picture that you're still making, is there not, called The Other Side of the Wind?
It's really done. We're just making pickup shots.
But it's been going on for 4 years, has it not?
Well, it started, and then it stopped because the job that I thought I was going to get didn't come through, so I couldn't finance it anymore. And then a couple of years went by, and I got a backer, and we shot a couple of weeks. And then that backer ran away with my money as well as his. And there's been that sort of history. It hasn't been shooting for 4 years. It's just a matter of weeks. But it just took all that time to get it together. And when you see John Huston in my picture, he gives a performance such as I've never seen on the screen. What's he doing back of a camera?
He's been there for a long time and been quite good at it.
Right, but the question still holds.
All of a sudden, he had a yearning or somebody such as
yourself. Well, I saw him as an actor before he ever came to Hollywood, too. So, it's, you know, it's... I think people, if you can do it, you can do anything.